Welcome back to Canucks Talk Sports at 650. Jimmy Dodd, Thomas Trancer, live from the Kintech studio. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Dunbar Lumber, with three stores to serve you in Ladner on Bridge Street, Dunbar Lumber Express at Ladner Center, or Arbutus in Vancouver online at dunbarlumber.com. Drance, something from the errors and omissions department.
Yeah, here. I've got to go to the errors and omissions department. I got it wrong. Canucks are favored -320. I just want to be clear. I think I described the Predators as favored. Just a slip up in terms of my overall speaking. I also slipped up on what Dom says of their odds. Dom has the odds at much closer to market, 77% likelihood of the Canucks advancing. So I was looking at, like, I pulled up the page and it had the wrong date. You know what I mean? Like, it was like a loading error. I know.
This,
you know what I'm talking
to me.
About. So I hit refresh and I was like, ooh, errors and omissions. Gotta note that.
There we go. Glad we got that. Glad we got that taken care of. All right.
Everyone was so mad. The inbox, people losing their minds.
People absolutely furious.
No one mentioned it. I'm just kidding.
Yeah, your job was on the line, really.
Like that time I said the F word. Anyway,
I wasn't going to bring it up. But by the way, we didn't mention this in headlines because there's so much to get out to or get to from the game last night. But we should mention, no surprise here, Quinn Hughes officially a Norris candidate announced today, along with Roman Josi.
First one in Canucks
and
history.
And Cale Makar. Wow. You're right.
Yeah. No, this is a big moment, man.
That is true. Holy cow.
This is a big moment. And, you know, it's too bad. Like, well, it's not too bad. I mean, it's great that the Canucks are in the playoffs and we have so much to discuss that we weren't able to, like, get off to this off the hop as the whiteboard began. But Quinn Hughes rocks. He's had such a good season. He's grown up so much as a player. I think what's phenomenal about Quinn, you know, they say about the great players, you know, you've heard it as like a truism about Crosby and on and on, is like they attack their weaknesses, right? That's a great player, and you know he's a great player because he identifies what he's not great at and then becomes really, really good or even excellent at it.
It's the adding something every summer thing, right? And
right.
The archetypal example for me is Michael Jordan learning the fadeaway jumper, right? It's
right.
Like, I'm not the most explosive dunker in the league anymore. Guess what? I'm going to learn to have just an absolute killer baseline fadeaway, and I'm going to win three more championships like that.
Very cool, right?
Yeah.
And I like it especially when a player identifies something that's, like not just something they're not good at, but something that is a genuine weakness in their game, or at least has been talked about as a genuine weakness in their game for years and years and years. And a couple of years ago, I don't know if you heard this, but yesterday, because Luke Hughes won the, or was finalist for
nominated
the Calder,
for the Calder,
nominated
yeah.
for the Calder, I asked Quinn Hughes about it. And Hughes immediately is like, you know, he played well. He played so well defensively down the stretch. I know the plus minus is ugly, but if you look at it, and you can fact check me on this, he was on the ice for 20 goals with the net empty. Like, Quinn Hughes knows how to diagnose that plus minus is bogus, right? And so I fact check it. It's 22. I of course, let Quinn know.
They score, 22 empty net goals against in a season?
Dude, the New Jersey.
That's a wild number.
The New Jersey Devils had a really weird season. Okay.
That's a wild number.
Yeah, like,
that's one every four games. More than that.
Well, they were, the Devils were the bizarro Canucks, right? Where it's like every game.
They were down. Instantly.
Immediately.
Yeah.
So -22 with only with your net empty, Luke Hughes finishes the season -25. Okay. With all of those counting as if they're like defensive gaffes.
Yeah.
He was outscored by 4 at 5-on-5.
Yeah.
We have to kill plus minus. Like, can we fire this into the sun?
Well, or at least just the empty net part of it.
Let's,
like, my goodness.
An idea. Let's just replace plus minus. Let's kill it because it's insane that it blends game state.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? It makes no sense. Let's just make it 5-on-5 goal differential. And let's just call 5-on-5 goal differential
plus minus.
Plus minus. And let's just fix a stat that makes no sense. The NHL needs to fix this. You know why? Because it actually specifically dings and makes their best players look worse. Like, what are your best players? When are your best players most likely to be on the ice?
Pressing with the net empty.
And on the power play, where you're not able to get credit for a plus. Where are your plugs most likely to be on the ice?
penalty kill.
And killing games and scoring into an empty net. Like, why have we designed a stat to make it look like Louis Erickson is cool and Luke Hughes is not? Like, it's bad marketing, man. Anyway, so
I wonder what the record for, I'm so curious, like 22. One player on the ice for 22 empty net goals against.
He didn't even lead the team.
That's wild to me.
He didn't even lead the team. The Devils had the most cursed season you've ever seen. Anyway, I love that Hughes knows it, though, right?
Like, yeah, that's incredible.
Unbelievable stuff. Sorry, coming back to it.
Quinn Hughes.
But Quinn Hughes knew to diagnose it in part because a few years ago, he was in the in the running for the green jacket, and Quinn Hughes takes this stuff personally, and so he spent time diagnosing where he could be better defensively, and he came back, and he's, you know, I never bought the defensive liability stuff. Quinn Hughes was always helping the Canucks outscore their opponents relative to how the team performed without him, right? Like, ever since Quinn Hughes arrived, this team has done one thing in terms of how they outscore their opponents with Quinn Hughes on the ice, and a totally different thing whenever Quinn Hughes gets a breather, right? That's been the logic of this team since. So Quinn Hughes arrived as like a two-way driver and an impactful one, but he did level up defensively and became just this monster where, you know, early in his career, there were times where he'd get got down low or times where he'd get got on dump-ins if the forward was fast enough to beat him to the battle. But it didn't really matter because with Quinn Hughes on the ice, you spend so little time defending anyway that you're still coming out way ahead. And all of a sudden, you know, after that sort of bubble season, that 2021 shortened season where his plus minus was atrocious, he came back and all of a sudden you were seeing him win way more of those battles, right? And now you were on to something that looked a little more Scott Niedermeyer than Brian Campbell, which, by the way, like, still great. Oh, my God. Like, that's a huge gap to jump. This past summer, he did it with his shot. He did it with his overall offensive impact and the gravity that can have. And
I think his shot and his mentality, too, his aggressiveness in the offensive zone, right? Because it's both. It's like the technique to shoot better, and then it's the probing mentality as well that he has now.
Oh, it's more the mentality.
Yeah.
It's more the mentality than the technique. Like, the technique is very much secondary. Anyway, I'll get more into this at some point. But so Hughes leveled up as just an attacking option. That's probably the safest way to say it, or the closest to accurate way to say it over the course of the season, but also took this captaincy really seriously, right? Made some significant changes in terms of his lifestyle, in terms of his approach to recovery, in terms of the way that he led internally around this group. And, you know, now he is the most important player and the highest scoring defenseman in the NHL on a team that won their division. He's not just a Norris finalist, for the first time in Canucks history any defenseman has been. He's not only already the best defenseman in Canucks history in this. Who cares about the points, to be totally honest with you? Like, this actually kind of seals it. No other Canucks defenseman has been at this level. Relative to their peers at any time when they were wearing a Canucks jersey. Like, this kind of seals it today. You can now, with confidence and without qualification, call Quinn Hughes the best defenseman in Canucks history. And he's going to win it. He's going to win it. And
it certainly seems like that.
It's just been special to watch.
Yeah, it's as I said, it's not a surprise at all. But as you point out, huge significance for Quinn Hughes, what he's accomplished, huge significance for the franchise. And, you know, by the way, while we're talking about Quinn Hughes, I thought he was really good last night. Like, I thought he looked a lot more like the old Quinn Hughes. And that was one of my biggest concerns coming out of game four, despite the Canucks winning, was what level can you expect from Quinn Hughes in the final games of this series? That's kind of flipped for me, right? Like, I thought he was, I don't want to say it was like a dominant game or anything like that for Quinn Hughes, but
he was excellent.
It looked more like Quinn Hughes. And if you're looking for reasons for optimism going into the final two games of this series, if you're getting that Quinn Hughes, that's such a huge edge for the Canucks. So I thought that was a big takeaway for me from last night, was just like, okay, good. We don't have to be wringing our hands about what we're going to see from Quinn Hughes over the final games of this series and potentially going beyond that as well. I did want to read this text that came in a little bit earlier. This one says, are they putting too much priority on defense and not scoring enough? We need to be able to score more than one or two goals. And this ties in a little bit to, you know, some of the frustrations bubbling over with the Canucks offensive production. Obviously, the shot totals, they continue to be in the record books for not scoring a lot. I think that question, the way of phrasing it, are they focusing too much on defense and not scoring enough? I don't think that's it. Like, I didn't look at last night and think, like, oh, this team's playing really conservatively, right? Like, I didn't even look at it as that punchless of an offensive performance, to be honest. They need to hit the net more. They need to bear down. I think there's some other things they could be doing.
I don't know, man.
But to the texter's point,
I would say that the Predators had, like, four of the six most dangerous chances in that game.
Yeah, that's fair.
Maybe five of the seven. You know, like, what would be, like, even the Canucks goal wasn't on a particularly dangerous opportunity. It was a sick play and a cool shot, and we'll get into Zadorov shortly. But what was other than the Suter chance, I guess, at the side and the Besser chance late, but like the Besser and the Pettersson 2-on-1, those chances are final 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what? This team's not sustaining offensive production until they're down late.
But I think yesterday looked like, I don't think it was a mentality thing, right? That it's like, oh, we're focusing too much on defense. And to the extent what I'm saying is, to the extent they play the way they do, it's because that's what's worked for them. You know what I mean?
Totally.
So I think it's unreasonable to expect all of us, because defense is their foundation. Of course it is. Now, that doesn't mean I think they're playing hyper-conservative hockey or they're not looking for moments to attack. They are. They want to be on the front foot. But defensive structure is what got them here. It's what's helped keep them in this series, get them a lead in this series. So I don't think it's a matter of them not prioritizing offense. I think there's some personnel limitations in the top six, in the forward lineup in general, that's making it a bit of a struggle. Maybe there's some tactical things, although I know Rick Tocchet's trying to address them. And, you know, again, last night, like, they didn't generate enough as you'd want to see, but relative to a lot of Canucks performances, even in games they won in the regular season, like, that looked pretty familiar to me.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that could be either a good or a bad thing, depending on your perspective, right? Because I know you and I talked a lot about how much they were struggling to generate at 5-on-5. But that, like, last night's game didn't look too out of step or out of character based on a lot of what we've seen from this Canucks team this year.
The first period would look like template Canucks hockey. And the reason that I would sort of disagree with the formulation of this team focuses too much on defense and not enough on offense is that the most conservative choices they make are with the puck, not without the puck.
Mm.
Like, without the puck, it's not like they're in a 1-3-1. It's not like they're dropping back. It's not like they're making teams come through 200 feet of ice. You know what I mean? Like, this team's desire is to play in your end of the rink and forecheck you, force neutral zone turnovers, and then set up lengthy shifts of ozone time in which conservative puck handling decisions are prioritized and shots, you know, two stick shots, as Rick Tocchet would call them, those deflection shots from the outside are acceptable, especially if there's layered traffic in front. I mean, the conservative decision is to avoid turnovers and not go for, like, sort of home run.
Yeah.
Passes in the offensive zone, to really prioritize not turning the puck over high in your zone. You know, you think about the way that Nashville's willing to take chances on the breakout versus the way Vancouver does. That's the big...
It's night and day.
It's a massive discrepancy.
Mm-hmm.
The Canucks are conservative with the puck. If you want to say, are they too conservative with the puck? Well, I've been wondering about it for 7 months, but I also can't argue with the results, so I haven't. You know, I've just sort of said, I wonder... Maybe this will matter. I have a little bit of concern that it does.
That's the thing. I don't want to, like, shut down the conversation about how the Canucks are going about their offense, but I think it's going to be a summer conversation because this is how they got here. They're not changing that part of their identity right now.
And if you do, you're dead.
Yeah.
Like, you first of all, this team trusts their approach. Secondly, they should.
Yeah, right? They have the buy-in. They have all of that.
They have the 110-point season that won them the Pacific.
Yeah.
Come on. Come on. No. Credit to them. They've developed a script that can win, and they believe that it can win, and we've seen in this series that it can win. In fact, the problem with it right now in this series is that we're not seeing that script enough, right? This team is not controlling play enough against another good 5-on-5 team, a 5-on-5 team that, frankly, I think is their equal. And as a result, they're not sort of loading the dice in their favor as we sort of roll bones on each game in this series.
This text,
I guess, throw bones, whatever.
Who cares? If you talk about Big Z, how do you think his playoff performance is affecting his next contract? Is he pricing himself out of Vancouver? Now,
arguably, he had long since priced himself out of Vancouver.
Like, he was already going to be really expensive. I mean, we had the conversation about what can Dakota Joshua do for himself with a good playoff performance in the UFA market. Zadorov was already really well set up to get a nice, nice contract, but you can bet that NHL general managers are taking note of what he's doing in this series, the way he's stepping up, the physicality, the offense, all of it. And again, is it the difference between him signing or not signing in Vancouver? I already, as you said, kind of thought that it was unlikely to happen, but he is not doing anything to, he's certainly not doing anything to weaken his market when he gets to free agency this summer, because this is exactly what the Canucks wanted to see from him. This is exactly what teams around the NHL will want to see from a guy like Nikita Zadorov in the playoffs.
Yes. So let's put the following parameters on it, okay? 15 plus points. Zadorov's a 20 point per season guy at least.
Mm-hmm.
He's had a 14 goal season, so he can spike. But like every season post pandemic, Nikita Zadorov has been good for 20 points for you. Okay. Play at least 16 minutes because there are tall, big 20 point guys who are still like specialists.
Mm.
So we want to weed them out. We at least want 4 or 5 guys in this sample. Okay. And then, and this is where we get hilarious, weight, 215 pounds, height, 6'3 or more. So we are talking about only beasts,
mm-hmm.
right? Like the biggest of the biggest guys.
And he clears both of those bars by a lot.
By a lot. 6'6", 230. Well, and this is,
he's listed at 248 on HockeyDB. Maybe he's trimmed down, like 248, that's enormous.
He looks 248, man.
He does.
He is a truck of a human being. And there are so many times in game, especially last night, where I thought he was particularly impactful. I actually started writing an impact of Nikita Zadorov bullet for our takeaways before the goal. And then me and Harmon laughed because like I was like two graphs in. I was just like, I'm going to do something on Zadorov. He's having a great game. And then he immediately went end to end and scored a howler that I was like, well, I guess that's the lead. And then, and then it wasn't that either. This is the challenge of writing in game. So Zadorov had so many sequences yesterday where like, the Canucks are maybe under a bit of duress, or there's like a puck that comes, and it's just like he just puts his body between him and the oncoming forechecker or whoever is in a battle with, and it's just like, LOL, Tommy Novak. Good luck, regular-sized human. No chance, right? Like, it's unbelievable. Anyway, we only get about 18 guys like this a year, okay? That's been true for the last 4 years, all of which Zadorov meets this standard. This season, he is the lowest paid of that group, right? There are 18 names on this list. Darnell Nurse, Dougie Hamilton, John Carlson, Brent Burns, Victor Hedman, Aaron Ekblad, Colton Parayko, Matthias Ekholm, Tyler Myers, Esa Lindell, Adam Pellick, Noah Hanifin, Ben Chiarot, Jamie Oleksiak, Josh Manson, Eric Goodbranson, Brendan Dillon. It's like a who's who of guys that sign on July 1 and everyone's like, why? It's like you're either a superstar.
Yeah, or you're like big with draft pedigree like Eric Goodbranson.
Or you're paid like a superstar and people don't understand why. Right? It's like it's the sticker shock department. Right?
Yes.
Season prior, by the way, I don't know how. It's literally exactly 18 names. And they're the same ones. Unbelievable stuff. Now, here's the other thing to note about this sample. Usually we talk about a 28-year-old as this like high-risk proposition.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously we should still do so when it comes
and
to guys.
By the way, he's 29, turned 29 a couple weeks ago.
Okay. And so obviously that has to still be a concern. But mm-hmm. like Ekholm's 33. You know, Myers is 33. He's held up pretty, like he's held up way better than you would have thought
mm-hmm.
when he signed that deal. Brent Burns is 38, still a monster. John Carlson's 33, still had 52 points this year, even though we all know that the Caps kind of suck. Hedman's 32, was almost point per game. Like, Big Z, in contrast with Big Zed, who plays in Canada, he had, like, his insurance license by the time he retired. He was, like, 45. He had, like, an expansive portfolio on Questrade. Like, guy was legitimately so old, and he was still excellent. Exceptional, in fact. I actually wonder if these really big players, wonder if these really big defensemen almost have, like, a higher floor. It's harder for them to decline the same way, perhaps, that it is for, like, your Carl Alsner type 6-foot defenseman who's a little bit more reliant on, like, mobility and whose body is maybe a little bit more subject to, like, the abuse the punishment that, like, life as an NHL defenseman requires, shot blocking on and on. There's something about the profile of, like, the 6'6", 240 guy who's, like, pretty fast that I actually wonder about. And I actually think the Myers experience that we've had, where he's outperformed all realistic expectations, and, like, I'm not going to say he's, like, broken an age curve or anything, but he's kind of broken our reasonable expectations.
Well, there's been no decline.
This is his best Canucks season.
Yeah, and really,
he's 34.
Like, even look at the 4 years preceding it, like, he was pretty much the same guy in all 4 years.
He's just Tyler Myers.
Yeah, he's just Tyler Myers. Like, he's the same as when they signed him.
He's, like, disturbingly ageless. Honestly.
Yeah, he is.
And I'm saying that is unbelievable. So, has Zadorov priced himself in Vancouver? Very probably it was always that way. Like, it had already been that way. The fact that he's now playing top pair minutes, though, you know, the one dynamic you're going to have is you're going to have meetings. Now, the Canucks are very, like, church and state in terms of coach versus general manager, right? Like, Tocchet has a lot of autonomy, and likewise, his input is solicited, but it's not, like, he's going to be shaping Vancouver management's moves. But, like, I promise you, there's at least going to be a phone call where it's like, hey, man, I love this guy.
I also, and look, this is a conversation for a later day, but, like, the Hronek versus Zadorov question is going to be a big one now. And I think I think it's deserved. Who's playing more at 5-on-5 in this series? Nikita Zadorov.
By a lot. Who's having a bigger impact?
Nikita Zadorov.
Who's having a bigger impact offensively?
Nikita Zadorov. And Quinn Hughes' minutes declined in game 4, right?
Was Hronek out there on the 6-on-5?
One of them he was, but not the tying one.
Right.
Zadorov was out there.
Yeah.
And who could you potentially trade to still get return? Well, Hronek.
And who's going to cost $3.5 million, right? Plus more years if you're going long-term on them.
Yeah. So it's like, I think it's a totally legitimate conversation to have, right? Like, where do you want to prioritize your dollars on the blue line at this point between those two guys?
Anyway, I literally think if Zadorov had not had a good playoffs, we were still talking about a guy who's just based on the uniqueness of the profile, a guy whose baseline was like 4x4 minimum. Minimum. Even if he'd like played badly in the postseason, just because there's not enough, not every team even gets to have a guy who profiles like this. You know, so, and the Canucks have two. It's going to be really interesting. A lot of their size is up from a sort of defensive perspective, plus your top pair right-handed defenseman, plus Ian Cole, who's just been a warrior in this playoffs. So, tough decisions looming on the blue line. I think Zadorov's impact is becoming plainer, and obviously it's just really cool to watch a guy that size do fun stuff and crush people.
It's super, super fun.
It's everything that's good about NHL hockey, really.
And everything that NHL GMs love. Like, a big guy crushing people.
No, but if you
call him right now, come on my team.
If you don't love Zadorov going end-to-end, but then also
awesome.
And then also like trucking Ryan McDonagh, like, I don't know.
It's pretty great.
Well, why do you watch hockey? Like, that's what hockey's about.
Okay, we'll take a break. Coming up, it's the crossover with Donnie and Dolly, Rick Dollywall and Don Taylor from Czech TV. Joining us next here on Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drance here. Canucks Talk is brought to you by Avenue Machinery and Douglas Lake Equipment. Be a champion on the worksite. Find them together online at dleamc.com. We are coming to you live from the Kintec Studio.
And we're not going to wait, right?
No,
we're
going to go right into it.
We're getting right into
it. We're going to go right into it. No time to spare.
It's my favorite segment of the week and Rick Dhaliwal's least favorite segment of the week. It's the crossover, baby.
It is the crossover with Don Taylor and Rick Dhaliwal. You can watch them Monday to Friday, 10 to noon on Donnie and Dolly on Check TV. The crossover is brought to you by Besant Motors, powering the playoff drive, home of over 400 pre-owned vehicles, and where the players go. Don, Rick, how are you guys doing today?
Very well. Very well. We've been working double time, so we're
you have
basically putting in the hours that you guys put in on a normal basis.
Maybe Dran.
Yeah, don't apply that to Jamie.
I have pretty good hours. I'm going to be perfectly honest. My hours aren't bad. Dran's works a lot more than me. But yeah, no,
I was being nice.
I appreciate it. But we'll get you guys out of here in a timely manner. Don't worry, because as you said, I know it's busy times for all of us.
And meters run double time on double time in the playoffs. The car meter, man.
Hey, look, it's all about meeting pressure with pressure at this time of year, as Rick Tocchet would say.
Oh, good comment.
Thank you, Rick. So what did you guys think of the Game 5 loss for the Canucks last night?
Oh, gosh, there's just so much that happens within every game. It just it's just such a blur. But my overwhelming thought, there was the goal that counted, that wasn't challenged. There was that. There was what Zadorov was up to. And the thing that I took away as much as anything was the Canucks had a 1-0 lead in the third period at home in a game that they could have closed out a series, and they didn't. And, you know, that's – and look, you could talk about Nashville blowing a lead in the third period the game before that. But focusing on the Canucks, man, I'm telling you, is that going to come back to bite them? And just the thought, if they go to Game 7, that they lose this series, they might have lost three games on home ice. And to have that 1-0 lead and not hold it is something else.
Rick.
Yeah, absolutely. And that when I – hold on a second. When I
see what I have to deal with.
I was going to talk, and we're not sitting next to them. I got to look at the screen. Anyways, listen, there was a time earlier in the season I said to Thomas, the Canucks are the number one scoring team in the NHL. Remember that? And Thomas said, oh, they're not going to be the number one scoring team in the NHL all season long, and which was accurate by Thomas. But I am a little surprised at the lack – they've got 12 goals in five games. They had five 20-goal scorers. You know, take Besser out of the equation. He's got four. Everybody else, Miller's got one. And so where's Pedersen? Where's Höglander? Where's Garland? Zeros across the board. Then you go to the issue with shots. And, you know, 12 shots in game three, and I don't know how they found a way to win the game. They are averaging 18 shots per game in this playoff series. In the regular season, they average 28 shots per game. Obviously, there's less time and space in playoff hockey. It's tighter checking. There's more blocked shots. The goaltending's better. All that stuff. But one of the things that has surprised me, hey, they've got 92 shots in five games. That's the second lowest total in NHL history after five games in a playoff series. So from the offensive side and the lack of shot side for a hockey club that had their way up till the All-Star game, and then their numbers dipped after that, I'm a little bit surprised at the offense or thereof lack of. And I know Pedersen's getting a lot of the heat in the market. Craig Button came on our show today, absolutely ripped him, and Mitch Marner in the same breath. There's a lot of heat on Pedersen right now. What do you mean, oof?
Oh, no, just
he's agreeing with
that's
you.
That's tough company. Mitch Marner's throwing his gloves.
Yeah. So, yeah.
I'm just saying, that's tough.
And Mitch Marner also, and Thomas, Mitch Marner was also on the front page of the Toronto Sun last week.
Yeah, looking invisible.
With the caption
the
that said,
man.
Invisible man.
Yeah.
Invisible man. So, look, it's Canadian markets.
Well, they're both making a lot of money. Pedersen will be.
Yeah. Pedersen's going to be. And, Donnie, you're right. The expectations, you can score a ton of points in the regular season, but if you got a high salary, you're asked to perform in the playoffs, and that's what the fans want to see from these high-paid offensive players.
Let's talk quickly about the goalie interference thing. Did you guys disagree strongly with Tocchet's decision not to challenge?
Last night, and last night's a blur. The post game shows are crazy here. We go on the air right after.
Yeah.
And I'm loving it. Don't get me wrong. Last night, I understood what Tocchet was up to. But the more I look at it, and Thomas, I know you disagree with that, but Josi got credit for the goal. He wasn't responsible for the puck going over the line. It was much more Nyquist and the push he gave to Shelov's body. I know Bluger was in there as well. I'm a little surprised on second look that it wasn't challenged. And I realize it's not just Tocchet. It's the video people as well, our friend Greg Hood and, yep, and Mike Yo and everybody. But most people, and this was our poll today, I think it was 72% felt that that goal should have been a problem. Yeah, that goal should have been challenged. Easier to say today than last night.
Shelov himself, did you catch the postgame, guys?
Shelov
said himself that I believe there was contact with me, but I don't know if it was my teammate or a Nashville player. So when the goaltender is saying that, guys, but Tocchet's got assistant coaches. They got video. They 30 years ago, they wouldn't have had that option. They have guys upstairs that are looking at it, passing along information. He felt it was 50-50. Okay, Tocchet's in a no-win. Because if he challenges and the NHL says good goal, then they're shorthanded again. And if Nashville would have scored on the ensuing power play, he would have got ripped for challenging. You're in a no-win situation as far as I'm concerned with him last night.
So he was definitely contacted, but the question is whether or not the contact was incidental. My sort of view of it anyway is that it's just too hard to rely on this, the difference between incidental contact and other than incidental contact, which is sort of what governs a loose puck in the crease. I just think you're leaving it with God if you're challenging that play, and I'd never want to be in that spot, given that, you know, my team had just sort of coughed up a third period lead on the power with a power play goal against. I never want to, if I'm talking anyway, I never want to have zero control. I never want to risk going shorthanded again for what I would have seen as a complete hope bet.
It has to be conclusive too, right? They have to see something conclusive in the play. That's the sticking point for me is, to me it looks inconclusive more than anything else, right? Like we're all staring at it, trying to figure out exactly what happened. If that's the case, are the refs really going to see enough to overturn the call, right? So like that's what it comes down to me. It's just a chaotic play.
You know, this wouldn't mean anything with a challenge or a review. I don't think it would, you know, play into the decision at all. But did you notice who led the flyby? It was Nyquist.
Yeah.
He thought he scored.
Yes. Yeah.
I'm pretty sure I've got that right. I don't think he touched the puck.
He pushed
Shelov's body, and that's how it went into the net. Maybe he did touch the puck underneath. I'm not sure, but he thought he scored. It ended up being Josi's goal. I thought that was a tell.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, Nyquist, I think, moved the pile. I don't know that his stick ever got in. I think it hit Bluger's skates. So then it's the question of, was he stopping?
That's the
was
feeling,
it intentional?
Yes.
That's an X factor.
Right? Yep. And it's really tough to... I just don't think there's any chance, frankly, that on review, given the call on the ice, that they were going to overturn that. Given just like the Renaissance painting of it all, there was too much going on to confidently assert, in my view anyway, that it was other than incidental contact, which is what would have been required to overrule the goal. So I thought it was a damned if you do, damned if you don't moment for Rick Tocchet, and I don't have a problem with a conservative play at that point in the game.
Yeah, and I would imagine that, you know, people are saying he should have had more confidence in his PK, which has been good.
Yes.
But I'm sure Rick Tocchet's part of his thinking was he has confidence in his team on home ice that they would score the second goal and win that game.
Yeah, it's still a tie game, right? I think he even said after, like, look, maybe if we were down at that point, then you need to be a little bit more risky with your challenge. But it wasn't as if it was the winning goal. Yeah. It was just the tying goal.
Pretty interesting, though, that over the course of the season, the Canucks ranked 30th. In total challenges over the course of the year. They had four challenges. They were successful on three of four. Only Derek Lalonde in Detroit and Rick Bowness challenged less frequently than Rick Tocchet over the balance of the season. So this might just be something, you know, where something that's sort of true to
philosophy.
Tocchet. Although we also saw some where it was like he probably could have challenged something for goaltender interference. But
in
it was
that,
also
in
the
4-1 game.
Yeah, but it was like the, yeah, right. It was like the 8-1 goal for San Jose. It's like, You remember that one? We all thought it would have been hilariously good. Petty if Tockett had done it. Yeah. So there were some moments where maybe he would have challenged if the game state required it.
On Elias Pettersson, I know you guys were saying Craig Button came on and was ripping him. Obviously, he's getting a lot of that. And it's I understand it. You know, you look at the game last night, I thought there were positive signs, but we're into crunch time, right? And it doesn't matter if there are positive signs unless there's a bottom line, unless the goals eventually go in. You know, maybe we're having a totally different conversation if he scores on that 2-on-1. Instead, it's off Saros' mask. But like, as much as there are steps in the right direction, we're also kind of running out of time to get Pettersson being a difference maker in this series.
Sorry, Rick.
One goal in his past 18. And look, everybody in the city, rightfully so, is, Tampa Bay's, I don't know if you guys saw this, their laundry list of injuries came out this morning. And, you know, there was a pretty significant. I mean, I don't think there's a ton of Canucks right now that are 100% healthy. We know, obviously, hey, DeSmith is back. He's doing really well. And he could have played last night, but they elected to go with Seelovs. And the other one for you guys is that, look, not a lot of guys are 100%. Would it surprise me if Pettersson's not 100%? It would not. If and when the Canucks season is over, you'll hear probably a magnitude of injuries, just like every other team that gets knocked out. If there is an injury with Pettersson, and it's the reason where guys that are elite, he had 89 points, and just to go into this last two or three, 4 weeks just makes me wonder if he's battling something.
Well, can I say something here? A couple of things.
Yep.
I thought it was his best game of the playoffs so far.
Yeah.
Tockett was asked about that, not just about Pettersson, but about that line with Mikheyev and Hoglander, and he was really short with his answer.
Oh, very short.
And kind of shrugged his shoulders. The body language wasn't positive. No. He just said they were fine.
Yep.
They were fine. And then he didn't say anything after that. It wasn't a ringing endorsement. So I could just tell, I think you'd have to guess that he's not happy with the way Pettersson in that line is playing.
No.
The second thing, guys, I don't know if you noticed it, and we meant to show this last night, but didn't have time for it, as it turned out. There was an area pass, and I believe it was thrown towards Pettersson in the first period, and there were two defensemen there, but it was a puck that I thought Elias Pettersson could have gotten to. An area pass where you're not, you know, passing right to the person you're passing to, but you're passing to an area he's supposed to skate into it. And he held up on the play. And to me, that just looked like a player who's hurting. That just looked like somebody who was shying away from contact. He hasn't shied away from contact this whole series, but that's not the only example. But I just thought that was pretty stark last night that he didn't go for that puck. Yeah, so I won't be surprised if we find out that he's injured. But that comment from Tockett, by contrast, was interesting.
Yeah, it was very short, terse, and he didn't elaborate on the line. He could have given an answer for 30, 40, 50 seconds. He didn't. He just said, yep, they were fine. And, you know, the body
like
language.
They were mediocre.
His facial expressions basically told you, move on to next question.
Well, sorry, Drance, but I wonder if Rick Tockett's running out of patience a little bit here, right? Because we get suggestions in, you know, hey, what if they juggle the lines to do this? What if they, you know, change it up, put the lotto line together? But at a certain point, how much time can the coach spend completely changing things to get one guy going, right? Like, he had success with Nils Höglander. Höglander scored 20-plus goals. So, I get it. It's not ideal playing with Ilya Mikheyev, but how much do you want to completely throw your lines in a blender just to try to get Elias Pettersson going at this point?
Well, I might put Lindholm with Besser and Miller. And I think he's done that a couple of times. Maybe that had to do more to do with faceoffs than actually trying to generate offense. You know, we're getting a lot of, or at least three or four submissions today into our inbox, guys, was, look, Pettersson's not scoring. He's not shooting on the power play.
Why is he on the power play?
Put, you know, like, I mean, I know a lot of people have a problem with this player, but he does have a pretty good shot. But Filip Hronek or somebody with a shot in that spot or somewhere on the power play. So we've had a lot of that as well. I wonder how many adjustments Tockett's going to make on Friday.
Yeah, we'll find out at practice tomorrow. I'm fascinated to see what practice looks like in Nashville tomorrow. But the thing is, and we saw it on the Hughes to Pettersson to Miller to Besser sequence on that 3-3 goal, like, there's still that ability to just, like, calmly look shot, dribble the puck while drawing defenders, and then defer to Miller. You know, it's not a huge play, don't get me wrong, but it was something. And it's still the sort of like calm under pressure, smart decision making, having the gravity to cause defenders to panic at least a little bit, that Pettersson brings, that a player like Filip Peronik, who also, I mean, how many points does he have in his last 41? Yep. It's not a huge haul.
His second half has been
not
good. Thomas, you nailed it. Yeah.
So I'm just saying.
But I was just talking about somebody who can shoot the puck hard.
Totally.
That's what I was. That's what people are saying.
Yeah, yeah. I understand what you're saying.
I'm open
what
to
Thomas
anything
is saying,
to fix Heroic the power
has not had a good second half.
No, and him and Hughes aren't playing much this series, which I think is a big reason, perhaps, why this team's not generating shots to some extent. Last thing on Pettersson, you look at that 2-on-1 chance, and there is no flex in his stick. And remember how Pettersson's wrist shot looked?
Yeah.
Or has looked for most of his career when he's got real torque and velocity. I mean, it looks like the stick's going to bend in half.
Yep.
It's a shock every time he doesn't snap his composite. And there was just very little downforce pressure for a guy who, you know, like is very nearly a scratch golfer and one of the best finishers that we've seen in the league over the last 5 years. That to me is also something of a tell. You want to go?
Yeah. Hey, I want to get I want to get the cartwheel report from you here. Is Dan Milstein as Nikita Zadorov's agent doing cartwheels after the performance that Zadorov has turned in so far?
Before Milstein, Taylor was tweeting out the money sign last night. I mean, Taylor's the new Taylor's the new the agent for Milstein.
Are you Gold Star?
No, the new agent for Zadorov. Taylor's now Gold Star.
Hey, listen, I work with this guy every day. I'm thinking about changing jobs, so you might be onto something.
Hey, I can confirm Dan Milstein is doing cartwheels.
Wow, there you go. Breaking news. Now that I got to see.
Hey,
can we get him to post it to social? Is he running up the stairs? That's what I want to know.
I text with Dan every day. And I can confirm he's doing cartwheels. I'm going to tell you something about Zadorov. There's going to be a lineup of teams for this guy on July 1st if he gets there, right? Yeah, there's going to be a lineup because he's coming out. This is a coming out party in these playoffs for Zadorov. Scoring goals, big hits. He's got 21 hits in the series so far. Team leading, he had 4 hits for the defenseman last night. This guy is playing unbelievable. And whether it's in Vancouver or somewhere else, he's going to get paid. And there's going to be term on this. And I'm not talking 3 or 4 years, guys.
Yeah.
I'm talking Milstein's going for term. And I do not see a situation where Zadorov won't get $5 million. I really believe that, and we'll see where it is. If it's in Vancouver, that'd be great. If it's not, it's going to be somewhere else.
Look, I know everyone's used to my like scientific analysis, but I just want to say, over the course of this playoff series, in multiple instances, I have had completely outside of conversation texts from both my parents saying, I really like that Nikita Zadorov. And that to me tells me
that's the fan favorite test right there.
They definitely don't watch a lot of hockey until it's like playoff time. You know what I mean? Like they're bandwagon fans.
They're doing cartwheels.
Everyone's doing cartwheels for Big Z.
If both of my parents have separately reached the conclusion that they love Big Z or Big Z, because we're in Canada, Big Z.
It's over.
Yeah.
Yes.
That tells you that this guy has achieved cult hero status. I want to ask two questions for you guys before we go, and we'll get you out of there really quickly. For Rick, who starts game 6? What's your sense of it?
Oh, it's got to be Seelovs. Did you hear him 2 days ago raving about Seelovs? Mm-hmm. DeSmith, I can tell you, is ready to go. He could have started last night, but that obviously the coach went with Seelovs. It's really interesting, guys. If Seelovs takes the and if he takes the ball and runs with it here in this series and until Demko comes, that changes the dynamics for me on what the Canucks do for backup next year.
Yep.
Now, obviously, Seelov's contract's up because he's an RFA. I don't think there's going to be issues signing him. But I know the club was really high on Casey DeSmith as well. And I know that the plan was to call his agent and check and see, you know, what it would take to sign him. But I'm asking you guys, and I'm trying to get this out there, like if Seelov starts another 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 games, playoff, and look, you guys know the pressure. He's a 23-year-old kid. You got to have nerves, right? And this kid doesn't show any nerves. And Taka keeps saying the moment is not too big for him. And watching him last night, we were watching the game together. And Donnie and I had Seelov as the player of the game, I think, after 40 minutes.
No question.
Both goalies were great last night. Yeah, you know, so
you had Pedersen as the player.
You had Pedersen. Donnie loves Pedersen. But listen, back to Seelov. If he gets the ball and runs with this, I gotta wonder if that changes.
let me say this, that the more I hear Rick Tocchet talk, the more I realize, and he's not the only one like this, but he really values somebody who's cool and calm under pressure. Yes. And he uses those words a lot with Artur's Seelovs. I think he feels the same way, Thomas, like you mentioned, with Pedersen on the power play. Yeah. Even though he doesn't shoot enough, in the opinion of many, he's pretty cool and calm. You talked about that. He really values that, especially under pressure situations. And I get the feeling he thinks Seelovs is more like that than DeSmith, at least at this point, even though he's not as experienced.
Okay, sorry. I know.
Seelovs quickly is whose draft pick is he? Who had a big say in his draft?
Ian Clark. Yeah.
Ian Clark had a big And who else?
Well, Judd Brackett. The Clark banging his hand on the table. Or, sorry, he wasn't at the draft table, but there was a joke among Canucks scouts. Every time they were picking from round three on, inevitably right before they came on the clock, someone would get a text from Ian Clark. Seelovs, like, take him! Chill, we'll get him.
They got him. Round six, I believe, in that one in Vancouver. I know we're supposed to let you guys go early. Sorry, there's just so much to get to, but I did want to ask quickly, Quinn Hughes officially nominated for the Norris today. I got to think he's going to win. I expect he's going to win. First time that this franchise has ever had somebody even nominated for the Norris. What does it mean for the player? What does it mean for this team to finally have a defenseman recognized as one of the best in the league like this?
Well, I tell you what, I've been watching this team since 1970. I'm a lot older than you guys, a lot older than Rick. Honestly, I was of the belief that a player like this would never, ever come around. It means a whole lot to Quinn Hughes, to the franchise, to Rick Tocchet, to everybody. It's just a joy to watch. And I just love when you hear people who watch him for the first time, even people who know a lot about hockey, but they watch him for the first time, whether it be on television or live, and their jaws drop. He is something else. We saw the play the other day in Nashville where he broke Nyquist's ankles. There's not many guys who can make a play like that under pressure. Talk about cool and calm. And it means a whole lot. I think he's their best player. And as far as winning that award goes, Quinn Hughes led all defensemen in points. Not everybody loves the plus minus stat. He's far ahead of the other two when it comes to plus minus. He's your winner. Craig Button has a vote. He said he's the runaway winner. That's what he told us today.
He's the runaway winner. Also, Quinn Hughes also does not like the plus minus stat. Was puncturing it in his in defense of his brother yesterday. It was quite fun. Can I do one last bit?
His plus minus a few years ago wasn't great.
I know are working long hours. Can I do one last bit?
This guy.
Sorry. I'm flying to Nashville, so I'm in one too. The usual Vancouver thing would be like, what's your concern level on the Canucks? But I want to spin it and be like this. Going into game six on Friday, Dolly, we won't talk until after the series is over. This is our last chance to set the stakes before one, maybe two big games. Going into game six in Nashville, where's your confidence level at that Vancouver finishes this off?
It's good because they just won two games in Nashville. And you know what? They just won back-to-back in Nashville. It's an environment they're okay with. You know, it's not an environment they go into and they go, oh my goodness, we're playing here. They just won twice there. I confidence level is good that they'll at some point win this series.
They haven't played their best hockey game yet. And I just haven't played their best hockey yet. And I have to believe that somewhere along the line in this series, that's going to happen. And if that happens, they win.
Jamie?
I'm still confident. Yeah. I mean, I don't know if I'm going to put a number on it, but they've got two more chances. Yeah. I think Donnie makes a great point there. They haven't played a real statement game yet in this series. You got to think they're going to do it at some point. Okay, we'll let you guys go. Sorry. No, you. What are you doing? What do you mean?
No.
You're 75% like.
Go to Nashville.
Don't I get a chance?
Turn his mic off. Turn Drance's mic off.
Go. Everyone knows.
Thank you guys.
I'm worried.
It was a blast as always. Have a great day. We'll catch up next week.
Nice guys.
That is Cheers, Don Taylor and Rick Dhaliwal. That was a very. I think we've had a couple in a row now that have been very like collegial. Like Dhaliwal referencing a disagreement you guys had months ago. To acknowledge that you were right, and it came exactly as you said.
Jaw
dropped.
I never thought for a moment that Dhaliwal would ever capitulate.
That was incredible. Stunned. Truly stunning stuff. But we're rallying together in the playoffs.
Completely.
All in, all together.
Nothing brightens my day like thorough capitulation.
Even Dolly, I made the like throwaway meat pressure with pressure, and Rick was like, yeah,
great
that.
Point.
He really liked that. I was like, all right.
Oh man, those guys rock.
Yeah, that was awesome. By the way, the crossover, you can check out the full edition of the crossover on our YouTube channel, on Sportsnet's YouTube channel every day. That'll be up shortly. Sky Avenue Kitchen and Lounge, discover Surrey's newest luxury dining experience. Experience the richness of Canadian cuisine prepared by a Michelin recommended chef. Reserve your table today at skyavenue.com. Drancer's here for one more segment. We'll take some of your texts. You mentioned how curious.
One more segment.
Yeah, how curious you are to see what happens at practice tomorrow in Nashville. I want to get into that a little bit.
And I'll be on the show after being at practice in Nashville.
Very,
that's the
very
benefit
excited.
Of being there.
So stay tuned. More Canucks talk coming up here on Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd and Thomas Drance here, live from the Kintec studio. Kintec, Canada's favorite orthotics provider, powered by thousands of five-star Google reviews. Sore feet, what are you waiting for? Canucks playoff coverage brought to you by Threadco Print Shop. It's the Lower Mainland's choice for exceptional branded apparel, quality screen printing, and embroidery crafted in their new state-of-the-art facility, threadcoprint.com. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. And in answer to your confidence question, Tanbeer texts in, I have zero confidence Canucks close this series out. PD is invisible. Hughes and Hronek have been mid. The team is struggling to score, and they have a third stringer in net. That's from Tanbeer. Dour outlook from Tanbeer there. The two things I take most that weigh on me the most of that list are PD not producing as much as there were steps in the right direction last night. You still need to produce. That's 100% a valid thing to worry about. And the team struggling to score in general. And, you know, you mentioned you're really curious to see what practice looks like in Nashville tomorrow. I talked to Halford and Brough this morning, which really goes to show you how we're scraping the bottom of the barrel for guests here on the station, that I was asked to appear on Halford and Brough.
No. That's a credit to you, Jamie.
Okay.
I don't want to gas you up on air, so I'm not going to, because it would
just
ruin
like,
our dynamic.
You're going to do it tomorrow, right? It feels like a lot of Canucks talk in the morning for them. But anyways, whatever. That's fine. I'm happy to do it. But
do you have an intro music yet?
No, God, no.
Well,
no,
then
no,
until
no.
You have intro music, man,
that's
like, don't worry about it. But you should have intro music. We need a Jimmy Dodd song. Can you imagine what A-Dog would do with a Jimmy Dodd track?
Barbershop Quartet.
Ooh. Ooh.
No, it would have to be It would have to be the most like 1990s like shock jock sports radio like all, guitar.
Oh,
cuz like that's what the Jimmy Dodd persona would be if I ever leaned into it. It would be like not like
so sorry.
You know, mid-90s.
I see. I disagree with you. I disagree with you both actually a little bit. I'm thinking of it more as like 1970s Tom Jones, where it's not really like a
yes!
song. It's more like a narration, kind of like the Jimmy Dodd version of Secret Agent Man. You know, that's kind of where I'm at.
No, I think it would be like, you know, like from like a morning zoo sports show in the 90s where it's like, oh, this guy's going to spit some hot fire now. Get ready for some hard truths.
Is that the Jimmy Dodd that personality?
Actually, that's what I think it would be.
No,
are,
no.
You know, some like some hot takes that are actually just like totally banal.
See, I think Jimmy Dodd is like a dictator. I think of Jimmy Dodd as like a Dick Tracy B character. You're kind of like,
right,
hey,
right,
see,
yeah.
I got the hot scoops. Yeah.
Okay. Anyways, they asked me about, like, what do you expect to see in terms of changes? Do you think Rick Tocchet will make a lot of changes? And I kind of said, I don't think so, because he's been so adamant about not making changes, and they still have the lead in this series, right? And we saw the one tweak early in the series where he bumped Sam Lafferty down, promoted Ilya Mikheyev. Now, Hoglander's minutes haven't been super high, right? So, like, Pettersson's still getting out there with the lotto line in some situations. But we haven't seen a lot of changes, and Rick Tocchet, pretty much every time he's been asked about it, has said, we don't need to make changes, right? Like, we just need to execute better. It's kind of on the players. I'd be a little surprised if he goes away from that message with his team still leading in this series right now.
It's pretty remarkable how few changes we've actually had. Like, we've had one right-handed defenseman who's a physical player for each team miss a game due to illness. And that's it.
That's it in terms of guys in and out of the lineup.
And then Canucks goaltenders have gotten
well,
hurt.
And Spencer Stastny got injured.
And Spencer
so they've
Stastny
had to call in, they've had to bring in two defensemen.
But okay. But only because of injury, right? Like, it's it's yeah, so it's the overall stasis of the dynamic of the series has been pretty remarkable. And especially in my view, because neither team has durably gained an upper hand. Right? Like, I mean, I think 3-2 is a relatively fair outcome for where this series is now. I think it could easily be 3-2 the other way. You know, I don't think either team deserved to be eliminated in five, given how close this series has been contested. And I just don't see any material edge for either team. Like, there have been games where the Miller line looks unstoppable. There have not been games where the Ryan O'Reilly line has looked unstoppable. That's kind of the edge, in my view. And yet, every other Nashville line, like the McCarron line, has been a factor in this series in a way certainly no other Canucks depth line has been. You know, maybe you can make an argument for the Lindholm line, but not on a shift-by-shift basis. More on a they've-come-up-big-in-key-moments basis, right? You know, the Sissons, like Zucker, Novak, Jankowski trio, they've had their moments. They've also struggled in moments. I think that's pretty analogous with what we're seeing from Pettersson, which is not nearly enough. We don't want to be throwing Pettersson into a conversation with Sissons, Novak, you know, Evangelista, Beauvillier and company, right? Mm. Like, come on. And that's sort of where I think if you're coming out of last night with some sense of hope, it's like, I do think at least Hoglander and Pettersson are beginning to find some sense of traction.
Yep.
The Pettersson shot last night, again, like, I see that on some level. I'm like, I'm happy he created off the rush. I'm a little nervous that the shot didn't have the torque that we're used to seeing. So it's kind of a mixed bag. But at least, like, Hoglander's starting to get in on the forecheck. He's starting to do that, like, sticky fight for every inch thing. You had a nice sequence in the first period where Pettersson dumped the puck in, and then Hoglander went to get it and, like, dumped Carrier on the way to the puck. And it's like, that's
Petey had a nice check separating the, like, freeing up the puck for Hoglander in the first period as well. And I hate doing this because then everyone's like, well, the bar is so low. And it's like, well,
where do you want the bar to be?
But also, like, Petey lowered the bar there.
100%.
And now he's got to incrementally raise it back to his level.
I mean, this is the biggest indictment, right? Is, like, going into last night's game, the Canucks had 9 5-on-5 shots in Pettersson's.
That's wild.
In Pettersson's 50 5-on-5 minutes. Last night, he played 12 5-on-5 minutes and had 7 shots. Like, I don't know. It's progress. It's not good enough. We all know this. You know, And by the way, so does he. You know, so does he. The only criticism that I'd sort of have is, you know, given sort of the stakes of losing that game, I think a lot about, like, how would the Twins handle it, right? Like, how would Barkov handle it? You know, Pettersson has that A on his jersey. Like, we live in a whiteboard era where the media makes requests of key players, and then those players are the only people in the room. You know what I mean? Like, It's not like it used to be where guys would be milling about. And I'm not even talking about like the old days of like yore. I'm talking about like 5 years ago, pre-pandemic. I would like to see, after like key losses at home, provided you're not like on drip or getting treatment, like key leaders should just be in the room. Like, available to take bullets. You know, JT Miller's done it every single game. Every single game, it's Miller up there.
Yep.
Handling the questions, honestly, giving, like, pretty interesting sound bites, grappling with these questions, honestly. Like, you know, after a key loss like that in the playoffs, given that your team's, like, this team's yet to score a 5-on-5 goal with Pettersson on the ice, like, I'd just like to see him stand there, you know, like, you don't have to talk necessarily. He wasn't asked for.
And he did talk after game two, but I understand, which was like his worst performance of the series, but I understand what you're saying, where it's like he's part of the leadership group of this team.
I just think, like, however it's done with the whiteboard or whatever, like, there's also some onus on guys with letters on their chests to just kind of be there. You know, it doesn't have to be Miller every night. And even if not everyone goes to Miller, like, some people, or some, not everyone comes to you, like, some people will. You're still gonna like take some of the burden off the one guy who's had to do it every single game. I'd like to see a little bit more of that. In terms of the performance thing, I just think people are conflating the fact that like Pettersson is struggling, right? If Nashville comes back in this series and Pettersson doesn't make an impact in game six and seven, this story is going to loom large, and it should. And it should, as like a descriptive result of this game. Where people are going to a place that I can't get to is the, like, Pettersson's not good side of it, or the...
He's a regular season player, like, right. All that stuff.
Yeah. His game doesn't translate to the postseason, he's overpaid, the Canucks should move on. Like, once you get into that level of emotional conversation, I just think you're detaching yourself from the reality of what this player has achieved over, like, a large sample in his career that tells us very, very, with a very high degree of confidence that he's exceptional. Right? Very special. And I'd add this, we've seen him struggle at times, and when we have, it's almost always been injury related. Almost always. So look, if the season ends and there's no injury news and it's just like, yeah, no, I just wasn't on my game, well, I'm going to weight that a little bit differently. But until we have that full context, which we won't have until the Canucks are done playing, I'm going to harbor a fair bit of like suspended disbelief, you know, in terms of how I evaluate this player.
So what I want to say to that point is just the way he's playing makes it seem like there could be multiple different injuries. You've referenced the lack of the flex on the stick, on the wrist shot, on the two-on-one, so that could be a wrist injury. He seems like he's falling down on the ice more often than he usually does. He's not able to stay on his feet. He looks fragile out there. So
I wouldn't use the word fragile. I would use the word stiff. There have been like plays where he can get it done with his hands, but doesn't seem to be able to get it done, like almost like a late career guy, or like I'm not speculating. I don't want to speculate. We will find out at some point, but I think your point is well taken. It's not just the torque on the shot.
Yeah, no, there's a lot of things you can point out to, and of course a lot of speculation about, is it just as simple as the mental side of things as well?
The texter accusing me of flexing on Jamie with his intro is amazing. It's like, yeah, but do you have an intro, bro? I definitely didn't mean to be big timing.
We're gonna have a big shouting match about that off air. How dare you? How dare you?
Andrew
do
Cole
that?
Has already promised an intro.
That's absolutely not true.
Oh man, I really want one.
Hold on. This text comes in terms of the, like, you know, lineup change. What do we see at practice and all that? James in Qualcomm Beach says, I've asked this so many times, never had a good answer. Please tell me why they don't try PD with Dakota Joshua and Connor Garland. And you're right. That has been suggested a lot. I completely understand it because those guys have had so much chemistry together. From my perspective, I think the thing that does is at that point, you're basically completely punting on two lines generating offense for you, right? Because I think the key for the Canucks is you have Miller, you have Pettersson, you have Garland as guys who can plausibly be offensive creators for you. You probably need to have those three guys on different lines to make sure you have three lines who can score. As soon as you move Pettersson with Garland, you're probably only going to have two lines that you think are going to be dangerous out there. Now, the rejoinder to the point I just made is, well, they're not getting anything dangerous from PD's line right now anyways, so how different is it if you load up a line with a couple of guys like PD and Garland? That's fair, but again, I think until your backs are against the wall in the series, I understand why Rick Tocchet wants to stick with what would be the best theoretical version of the lineup if everyone's clicking. And it's the same reason why I think don't take PD off the power play. Your best version of the power play is going to involve Elias Pettersson playing well. He's not playing well right now, so the power play, in part, because of that, is going to struggle. But this, they're not in an elimination game yet, right? Like, maybe they are. They find themselves in that spot, and you really have to take dire action, and you do have to, you know, punt on two lines to load up the other two. But until you're in that spot, like, until you're on the precipice, I get wanting to go with what you think your best lineup is and give everyone a chance to figure it out. I completely understand that.
I just want to address something really quickly. I'm sorry to deviate away from the Pettersson conversation. I'm sick of throwing the red meat, though, to the people who just are like, you know, it's simple. Pettersson's not good. It's like, man, it is not simple. But anyway, someone's texts in unsigned. Durant's always paints this series picture with a biased viewpoint, and it's because he wants to be so right about his Nashville is really good and the series will be long take. I'm already declaring victory there, so don't worry about it. There's far better ways of judging who's been better than shots that hit the net, and most of this series, Canucks have controlled play, generated chances, had more offensive zone time, and been the better team. Last game, high dangers were 7-0 Canucks. After the first, Nashville was very lucky they weren't down 2 and were lucky they won this game. I think it's fair to say that the Predators were lucky they escaped the first period level.
Absolutely.
But I also think it's fair to say that the Canucks were lucky they escaped the second period level. So I just want to give you this, because these teams have played 163 minutes when the score was within one, because most of the series has been within one. This is 5-on-5 only. Okay. 145 shot attempts for the Predators, 145 shot attempts for the Canucks. Predators are plus 14 in shots, but the Canucks are plus 3 in unblocked shot attempts. I'm sorry, but if you're watching this series and think either team is decisively better than the other in neutral game states, you don't know puck. You're watching the wrong stuff. You're paying attention to the wrong stuff. This is a razor-thin series that is insanely low event, which throws a massive premium on every breakdown, every miss, every goal scored. Every game is being decided by one shot, one bounce, one stop, one moment, one non-challenge, one weird call.
One opportunity. Are you going to call?
You only get one shot.
Let it slip.
Do not miss your chance. Oh, man.
Good reference. That was a sick reference, Tom. I got to be honest.
Huh?
Were you doing that on purpose?
I was not. Absolutely not. I was in no way thinking of mom's spaghetti. Anyway,
quickly before we let you get out of here,
Dom, you could say I was freestyling. Okay, sorry.
Before we let you get out of here,
yeah,
I thought Rick.
It's an 8-mile trip.
Again,
to the airport.
I hate to just keep piling on the compliments from the crossover, but I thought Rick made a really good point about if they do
I don't know what's happened.
We're simpatico over the last couple of weeks, but I hadn't thought about this, right? Because Rick made a really good point. Again, I'll say it. If Shelovs takes the ball and runs with it here and becomes, you know, not just because of injury, but because of preference by the coaching staff, the first choice goalie while Thatcher Demko is out, I do think that makes the goaltending conversation really, really interesting going into the summer. Because if you trust Shelovs over veteran backup Casey DeSmith to start playoff games for you, don't you kind of inherently then trust him to start, you know, 35 plus games for you next season?
Well, you better.
You certainly should.
But you better. Like, if he's your backup and he's 23 and he's shown this level of, like, preparedness, ceiling, athleticism, size, all the stuff you like, calmness, then you don't want him to play 20 as a backup. You want him to play 35. You want him to play 40. And this is sort of the other thing you have to be really careful with, I think, in designing your plans in net, is you've got a big edge with Shelovs if he's ready and if you don't make him your backup. And that's that he can go up and down without requiring waivers next season. So, you know, is it cool to have a really good backup? Oh, yeah. Is it even cooler? I'm doing the Justin Timberlake from The Social Network. What's really cool is having an elite third goaltender and another reliable backup.
Mm.
Like, volume. Volume.
Well, especially, I mean, I think it has to
think
be a volume.
Think of it as pitchers.
It has to be a volume thing with Thatcher Demko at this point, right? Like, I don't want to get into that right now. We're like 2 minutes from you jetting off to the airport about the, like, is Thatcher Demko injury prone?
Yeah, I'm not there.
But you have to at least, like, it has to be more of a part of your contingency planning, right?
Yeah.
And if that means, okay, we're going to keep Shelovs as, like, ultra-luxury insurance in the third spot and still go out and get a good backup, that makes sense.
You know how much I've focused on durability as sort of, like, the final frontier for Demko.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that, like, I'm not taking the leap from that to be, like, critical of the player. You know what I mean? The fact is Demko's such a high-level puck stopper that if you can at any point get, you know, 60 reliable games from him year in, year out, like, that's amazing, right? Like, at the end of the day, the teams with the highest save percentage are the teams with, like, the highest level starter that plays the most year after year. And one thing to note is, like, since Demko sort of became the Canucks de facto starter midway through that bubble season, Vancouver ranks as a team 18th in save percentage, right? And it's like, most games you go into with Demko, you're like, we have the best goaltender, right? But there's a lot of those games that end up being like Delia or Martin or,
mm-hmm.
you know, Shelovs or
DeSmith,
where, you know, that kind of brings your team back to average, even though on paper you have the better goaltender. I'd still love to see Demko, like, get another shot to do it. You know what I mean? Like, I'd still love to see Demko be a number one. I think he can. I really think he can. It's just, it obviously hasn't gone his way yet. And at by the time you get to be 28, 29, 30, I do think you need to be, like, sharp about building contingency plans, which just really quickly before I go brings me back to the old Jeff Sullivan point about pitchers. If you want five healthy starting pitchers at any given point, and this MLB season has really emphasized this, what do you need? You need seven starting caliber pitchers because they're not all going to be healthy at once. I just think you have to design a goalie program with similar things in mind. Like, it's not even about having two good, like, reliable starters now. I think it's about having three and having a guy who's potentially, like, a guy you'd feel comfortable starting 30, 35 times as your third goalie. Man, that to me is, especially if you're, like, in a win now window, you know, especially with the age of these Canucks players all in their prime or, you know, sort of at the point where you begin to worry about aging curves. Like, to me, that's the edge that the Canucks can have in net almost requires another vet to come in as well.
All right. Drance is off to the airport. He will be on the show tomorrow from Nashville. We'll be able to find out how Rick Tocchet and the coaching staff adjust or react to that Game 5 loss. Safe travels, man. Ryan Clark is going to join me next here.
Say hi to Ryan for me.
I will. Canucks Talk brought to you by Avenue Machinery and Douglas Lake Equipment. Be a champion on the worksite. Find them together online at DLEAMC.com. More Canucks Talk coming up here on Sportsnet 650.